Welcome to the ASRS Oral History of Retina series. The purpose of these interviews is to capture firsthand stories from individuals with unique retinal insights of historical significance.
Through these discussions, we will fill in gaps in our understanding of the evolution of the science and practice of retina. And it's our hope that these discussions will serve as the illuminating element in the larger mosaic of the history of retina.
I am so pleased to be here with my good friends, Dr. Tom Auberg Sr. and Dr. Tom Auberg Jr. Tom Sr. is Chairman Emeritus of Emory University School of Medicine, Department of Ophthalmology, having served as chairman there for 20 years, between 1988 and 2007. He began practicing retina at the very beginning of the vitrectomy era, and his CV reflects that fact, that he was at the right place, at the right time, and he was the right person to make the most out of that golden opportunity. He participated in dozens of seminal scientific studies, publishing over 150 scientific papers, writing 20 book chapters, and giving hundreds of scientific presentations across the globe. He trained many dozens of retina fellows, most of whom then went on to train hundreds of their own retina fellows, resulting in a ripple effect in retinal education that has impacted thousands of retina specialists and their patients, and will continue to have such an impact for years to come. Tom, by any measure, you have had a monumentally impactful retina career.
Thank you very much.
And Tom Auberg Jr. has had a ringside seat to the early evolution of the vitrectomy era through the eyes and mind of a child and young adult, and later as he carved his own remarkably successful retina career, with a similar interest in surgical innovations and an additional niche in ocular oncology. He too is a prolific researcher and author, having participated in over 40 clinical trials, published over 50 scientific papers, and continues to be a highly sought after speaker at retina meetings across the globe. It is such a privilege to have both of you here today.
It is an honor.
So Tom Sr., let me start with you. Your ophthalmology residency was at Mass Eye and Ear from 1962 to 1966. What piqued your interest in ophthalmology?
My interest was primarily from listening to David Colgan, who was lectured to the students in their third and fourth years in medical school. And he had just such a magnetic effect, because he wanted everybody to learn, number one, and better yet, learn about ophthalmology. So I admired him so much, and that got me on the road.
What got you from interest in ophthalmology to interest in retina?
When I went up to the laboratory before I started the clinical work, I worked with Carl Kupfer and Jun Kinoshita and Tuichi Kuwabara. And they, at that point, they were doing trypsin digested studies of the retina. So they digested away all of the non-vascular tissue. And I was amazed. I thought, wow, you see all these vessels coursing through this tissue that you otherwise don't see. And I was just overwhelmed by that. And that got me interested in research, number one, and retina, number two.
And so did you take the normal path and just applied for a retina fellowship and then went on to retina fellowship, or?
No, I actually had a little side trip that went, when I got to my rotation on glaucoma, Dr. Morton Grant, I was overwhelmed. I thought, this is so amazing that you can see this, the angle, and you can see the structures that are being obstructed. And so then I changed again. I said, okay, I'm gonna go in glaucoma now. And even at the end of my residency, I was planning to go into glaucoma, and I And by that time, Carl Kupfer had gone out to the University of Washington in Seattle. And he still remembered that I worked with him and that I was reliable enough that he would trust me. And so he offered me a job.
So you made a big impression on him.
I guess, yes. Thank you. So he offered me a job in glaucoma. And but I had a service commitment.
Something happened.
You're right. Would you like to know what? Yeah, well, I had a co-resident with me, Arnold Kroll, who went down to Bascom-Palmer and was doing retina work at that point. He was doing it with Dr. Norton, who was the head of the Institute, Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute. But I'd heard from David Kogan about Dr. Norton. They were close friends. I'd heard so much about him that I asked if I could come out just to meet him. I thought that would be really cool to meet an icon in the field. So I had the opportunity, being in the service, to go out to the Public Health Service Center in Florida. And when I was there, I asked if I could then, on the way back, go down to Miami and meet Ed Norton. And they said that was okay, so I did. We went and had breakfast, which was his typical day, apparently, which I later found out. He always had breakfast at 7 o'clock at a little restaurant across from the old Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute. And he met me there and said, okay, when do you want to start a fellowship? And I said, there's a misunderstanding, sir. I really wanted just to meet you. And since Dr. Kogan and his eyes lit up because they were such good friends, said that you were building such a wonderful department down here. He said, oh, you're not here for a fellowship. I said, no, sir, I really am not. I'm going to go into glaucoma. And so we had then a nice talk and got home back to Oklahoma, where I was stationed, and the phone rang. And he said, this is Ed Norton. I said, yes, sir, what can I do for you? He said, well, I've talked to Victor Curtin. Victor was the one that you had to get approval from Victor if you ever were going to get a position there. And he said, and Victor said that he had talked to Arnold Kroll, and even though I'd missed talking to Victor, he approves of your coming. So when do you want to start? I said, well, there's been a misunderstanding. I'm going to go into glaucoma work at University of Washington in Seattle. He said, what? I said, yes, sir, I'm committed to that. He said, okay.
You're about to leave on a plane for University of Washington.
Within a couple of days, in fact. I called up Carl and I told him that I had offer to have training in retina at Bascom-Palmer. And he said, well, if you get it, I'll understand. He was very understanding. And I called back to Ed Norton and said, is that offer still open? And he said, yes. I said, I'll take it. And that was it.
So if it weren't for a kind of a serendipitous breakfast with Ed Norton.
Right.
You'd be a glaucoma specialist today.
I don't know how good I'd be at it, but that was my interest, and I certainly planned on it. Yeah.
Wow.
Serendipity. That is it.
Indeed. So you did your retina fellowship at Bascom-Palmer from 1968 to 69. The first published open sky vitrectomy was performed in 1951 by Sugio Dodo in Japan, but the second publication of this type was by David Kastner at Bascom-Palmer at this time. What was that like? What was the reception that that Open Sky Vitrectomy technique had, and what was your impression of it?
Right. We thought it was not a reckless thing to do, but a courageous thing to do. We knew that David was an incredibly good surgeon, but you know, taking out all the vitreous that you could seemed risky. And at that point in time, people would do anything not to touch the vitreous, including if it started coming out of the eye, you cut it away from the wound, but you didn't want to go in and taking it out. He showed that he not only could do it, but in a case of amyloidosis, the case that he reported at the academy where he talked about doing open sky vitrectomy, he cleared out the whole vitreous cavity, well, almost, but enough that the person could see. And so that, again, was a remarkable step.
And you and Robert Mockimer were co-fellows at this time, is that right? He had been there for a couple years earlier because he was doing some research at Bascom-Palmer, and then you were co-fellows. Did both of you look at that as something that was intriguing? Did you... What led eventually to some modifications of that open sky technique?
It was not only intriguing, but Robert was very insightful about trying to figure a way around a problem. And so he devised a way, first of sucking it vitreous up into a syringe and then cutting it out. And finally, we just used what was the first really a vitrectomy instrument, which was just a dental drill that would cut it and suck it up and cut it with, pretty simple actually. But that was it.
So Tom, in 1969, you were an author with Ed Norton, Bob Mockimer, Wayne Fung, and Victor Curtin on two papers on the subject of giant retinal tears and its management with intravitreal air.
Uh-huh.
And this was before vitrectomy.
Uh-huh.
So we're injecting air into a vitreous filled eye to fix a giant retinal tear.
Right.
How'd that go?
It's
hard to imagine that would go well.
Once you get a giant tear, most of the gel has liquefied and usually settled inferiorly, hence tearing even more. But as it turns out, we did unroll it by a series of maneuvers. You tip the patient's head over. But the problem was that, which wasn't realized at the time that paper was written, is that everything then was compressed forward as the patient would go back, laying on their back. So and when they did that, everything got pushed forward by the bubble that was there, because it wasn't a total bubble. So we started using just an ordinary air pump from an aquarium. Worked.
We don't talk about this much, but that's pivotal to be able to do a fluid air exchange. So you remove all the membranes and the traction, but you've got to reattach the retina. There certainly was no perfluorocarbon liquid then.
Yeah.
And so you had to do this fluid air exchange, and there wasn't anything but a syringe before the pump.
Well, there were. But the problem with the syringes is that, you know, you'd have leaking wounds.
Instantaneously.
And then you'd have to go refill the syringe. And, you know, because one thing led to another. It was more the air pump was magic.
Pivotal. Absolutely pivotal.
Yeah.
So you left fellowship and became director of the retina division at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, eventually putting that program on the map for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, in this day and age, this would never happen. So do you remember how you started that? Who were your first hires?
This was in retina at the time, and so we started a fellowship program there. They had no fellowship program in retina. And I called my previous mentor, Ed Norton, and said, you know, do you think it would be possible or advisable to have your own fellowship program start here so we could now get other people that would be available in the community to do work, retina work? And he said, sure, that'd be fine. And I said, well, that's what we'll do. So the next year, we started a fellowship program in retina.
So you didn't hire previously trained retina specialists? No. You had fellows, and then the first fellows became faculty?
Yeah. James Kingham was the first person to join the retina section, but he was also a resident there before.
So Hank Edelhauser. Many people don't know who he is, but, you know, he was very involved in research. He was a co-author on many of your papers. Tell me a little bit about him.
Hank Edelhauser was one of the most remarkable men I've ever met. He was PhD, of course, and I viewed it that I would create the problems and he would solve them.
Am I correct that he invented what we refer to as BSS?
Yep, that was what he did.
That's a pretty big contribution to the world of retina.
All the difference in the world.
Wow. So give us a sense of what the operating looked like in 1971, 72.
The old VISCs, anywhere from 4, 5, 6, 7, and went up to 10. I don't think it was more than that, but maybe there was, but I had up to 10. They're all different models. But the big problem was they were rotating, cutting instruments, and invariably something would go wrong during the surgery and it would jam. And it would jam with vitreous still in it, and then you'd have to somehow cut it away so you didn't rip everything out of the eye when you took out the instrument. So the big step forward was not only the instrumentation, but getting the visualization afterwards during these long procedures, which is where the solutions that Hank came up with helped immeasurably. And then the instrumentation, which mostly was, as I remember it, done at stores, was just remarkable. They would come up and view what we were doing and then say, you know, we could, if we make a few adjustments in the instruments, we could do this better.
So at this time, besides having the cornea go because you had the incorrect solutions, although you finally surmounted that with BSS, you're using handheld irrigating lenses, little prisms where it's very difficult to see the periphery, illumination's not so great.
Right.
Did you have endolaser in 1971?
Oh, no.
So you were using cryo?
We used cryo.
Yep.
But cryotherapy wasn't when I first started. The previous cryo machines were pretty clunky things, and the change in the cryo units was also dramatic.
Well, clearly, because many of your early papers had to do with massive exudation after sclerobuckle and cryo,
yeah. Right,
which we don't, it just doesn't happen now.
No.
But it had to do with the type of cryo, or I guess the extensiveness
yeah.
of it.
Yeah.
Remarkable. So in 1987, you published a paper on the topic of intrusion of retinal tacks. You published that with Hillel Lewis, who was a former fellow of yours, I believe.
Yes.
Kirk Pacco, Preston Richmond, Mark Blumenkranz, and George Blankenship. A really who's who of authors. That's quite remarkable. But it's also remarkable that you were sticking tacks through the retina into the wall of the eye, which sounds sort of barbaric.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about these tacks. Were they stainless steel? It's crazy enough that they're tacks, but what kind of metal are you sticking in the eye?
The tack construction was my contribution to it, but the metal portion is Tom's, Junior's. Because he told me, he said, you know, airplanes don't rust, and that's because they have titanium in them. I said,
No.
That seemed intriguing.
So it wasn't quite the airplane analogy, but that's okay. It was,
I was an engineer at that time, and I was working in materials and mechanics and working on various prosthetic devices. And so I had simply made the suggestion of titanium over stainless steel. And
that's a pretty important suggestion.
It sure is.
It's sort of like, well, we'll just make an air pump, you know? I mean, it's the little things that... What about the delivery system? How is this done? And
No, sorry. It was like a pea shooter. Let's just call it what it was. It was a pneumatic device. It was a metal tube, and you had the tack in the end, and you stepped on a switch, and it popped that tack right through. But you had to be exactly perpendicular to the wall of the eye.
So, Tom Jr., you started your academic career at Dartmouth from 81 to 85. You got a BA in engineering from 85 to 86, hence the contribution of a titanium tack. You went to med school at UW-Madison, 87 to 91. Ophthalmology residency at Bascom-Palmer, 92 to 95, and then a retina fellowship there as well. And then after fellowship, you joined the Emory faculty and made some significant changes to the ocular oncology program there. Where did you gain the expertise to do that? And tell me a little bit more about those changes.
During my Bascom retina fellowship, I worked with Tim Murray. Tim Murray was a relatively new faculty member, and he came to Bascom to do oncology. And I worked with him a little bit during my chief residency year as well, which followed. But there was still a propensity of radiation therapy for these kids. The chemotherapy, the chemo reduction really hadn't caught on. But there was a lot more literature on it, and it certainly made a lot more sense once you looked at some of the secondary complications from radiation therapy. So this was solely in the retinoblastoma world. Well, I ended up going out to University of San Francisco, California, and that's where I did a rotation in ocular oncology. At the time, they had the ocular oncology fellowship divided between intraocular and Orbit. I am married to, I think, the best oculoplastic surgeon in the world. She took the orbital part of the fellowship. I took the intraocular portion. And I worked with Joan O'Brien primarily on the retinoblastoma. I worked with Devron Char for melanoma. Fortunately, Emory happened to need an oncologist, an ocular oncologist. And so a position was offered to me. They needed a second oculoplastic surgeon. And so a position was offered to Melissa.
Serendipity there too.
Serendipity as well. And in keeping with making sure everything was on the up and up, my chairman was actually not my father. My chairman was the head of neurosurgery. I was the only, well, besides Melissa, was the only ophthalmologist in the department that actually answered to someone other than senior.
Very interesting.
But I brought other things, but retinoblastoma was a chemo reduction, and we created a very robust service for really the Southeast.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure.
So you were co-author of the second edition of the book Vitrectomy with Robert Mockamer. Did it take long to finish that second edition?
Let me just tell you from a fly in the wall standpoint, because I was part of this journey. So we have a cabin in northern Wisconsin, Little St. Germain, Wisconsin, 5-hour drive. And it's the three of us in my dad's BMW, my dad's most precious thing, 2002 TII. Robert, being a mechanic, was listening to the car driving and heard a tick, 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 tick sound. And he said, "Tom, do you hear that tick, 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 tick sound?" And my dad said, "No, I don't hear it." And he said, "You have something wrong with your car. It has to be fixed." My dad is like, Robert, it's okay. We finally get up to Little Saint Germain. The rules Robert laid out very clearly. He pulled down all the shades. He took down all the clocks. He had a stash of food, which really wasn't very good. It was Doritos, donuts, and beer, I think, something like that. And I was in charge of periodically taking pictures. And the rule was they would write when they were awake, they would sleep when they're tired, and they would eat when they're hungry. And that was it. So they would do just that, and periodically my dad would get tired and he would go off and take a nap or something. But Robert, being Robert, ended up going into the garage. And it turns out he was disassembling my dad's BMW dash, and he had all the parts laid out on the garage. Well, they wrote the entire book in 1 week. And at the end, my dad was a little concerned because there was still, his car was not quite back together yet. But we couldn't leave, obviously, until it was. Robert got it all back together. And we started driving back. And Robert turned to my dad and said, see, there's no tick, 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 tick anymore. And my dad said, Robert, I never heard it in the first place. And he said, well, I have it fixed. You can thank me. And then he handed my dad this Tupperware. And in it, there were a bunch of parts. And he says, by the way, these are some extra parts. I'm not sure where they went, but BMW always put extra parts in anyway. You might want to keep that just in case you needed it. When he sold the car, he sold it with the little Tupperware.
So that was a pretty special relationship you had with Robert Mocker.
Oh, it was. You know, I'd never had a brother or a sister, but Robert came very close. He was family, and we could talk over anything.
There's obviously many special benefits of being a father and son in the same profession. Any downside?
There was obviously some benefits for me, being the junior. One in particular was when I was a fellow and I had written probably one of my first papers on endophthalmitis with Harry Flynn, and I had submitted it to ARVO, and it was accepted. And then I received a letter asking me if I would be a co-moderator, and I believe it was with Bernie Doft.
As a fellow.
As a fellow. And I, of course, was certain that they had made a mistake that many people had been making at the time. And I called up my father, and I said, Dad, I have a letter that it says Tom Aubrey Jr., but I'm sure they meant Tom Aubrey Sr. They want you to co-moderate a session on endophthalmitis. And my father said, well, if it has your name on it, I think it was meant for you. And I said, no, I'm very certain it was not. So I ended up calling up ARVO, and I spoke to someone, I don't remember who, and I expressed my concerns that a mistake had been made. They reassured me they had not, but they will check into it, and I never heard anything. So I show up, and Bernie Doft is sitting up there at the table, and I sit down, and I am certain he was expecting Tom Aubrey Sr., and I introduced myself as Tom Aubrey Jr. He got past the perplexed look pretty quickly, but I marshaled on and co-moderated.
So, and it all went well.
And it all went well.
And you've been moderating since. What do you think is the most significant change you've seen in retina in general in your lifetime?
You know, some of the big things that I think impacted retina surgery, I was starting my career when those were really hitting the ground. So the heavy liquids, silicone oil, what have you. So really the change that occurred during my career that changed how I could operate. The first was probably wide field viewing, going from those, you know, infusing contact lenses and the fellow who was falling asleep at the oculars and that kind of thing, to really getting that global picture.
I was trained by the Skeppens technique of doing scleral underminings and putting buckles outside the eye to indent it, and using diathermy in the bases of it to get it to adhere. To now we're talking about moving into the eye and putting the adhesive barrier, be it laser, or any photocoagulation, or even cryotherapy, but that isn't the most, mostly laser, inside the eye, and then putting a bubble or silicone oil or something inside the eye to hold it in place. So we've moved from outside the eye to inside the eye, and that's where the action is. That's the easiest way to do it.
Any regrets in your career?
Yeah, that I've gotten older, and but I'm so impressed. I still think that the treatment of most of these problems that we have is going to end up being some intraocular infusion, medication infusion in the future, where we either just dissolve the stuff we don't want, and or we administer the medication that we want, and to some extent we're certainly doing that already, but I expect there'll be not anywhere near this mechanical means that we're now going through.
Tom Jr., any regrets in your career?
I gotta say, I don't have any regrets. I think all the decisions that I've made have worked out well. They certainly worked out well for you.
The best.
Yeah.
The best.
It has been such a pleasure chatting with the two of you today. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure being here.
It has really been super special.